This is the first in a series of lectures on the value of the humanities. I'm going to give you some orienting statements about it before I begin. You're really getting the gist of a book that's just gone to OUP and will be coming out later in the year. An important thing to tell you, to warn you about, and the university advertisements for this did tell you this, this is not a polemic. Most of the work in this genre is manifesto or polemic. A, that's not really my forte, but B, I think it is a problem for our discipline often that is not collectively our forte, that it doesn't show us doing the things that we do best. Somebody said to me when I first started working on this subject, a wise, philosophically and historically minded individual, don't you think the humanities are best justified simply by our doing them? One of those abrupting questions that strikes you early in your project and makes you think, do I really have a book here? I think she was right, but I also think that she can't be right in a context where we're under pressure clearly to account for the taking of public money. The act of justification has seemed to many humanities scholars, this is sometimes a view associated with Stanley Fish in the United States, but it's by no means just his. The act of justification has seemed to beg more than one question, that the value of the subject area is in question when we might want to not to allow that supposition. And that the value is capable of being expressed in the mode of justification. The particular form of justification that involves articulating reasons why we should consider the higher study of the humanities, so specifically university teaching and research, a public good, is a modern problem undertaken by institutional, political, and economic pressures. Its practitioners can look for inspiration, I think, to two related genres, both of which have a distinguished history. The defense of poetry and advocacy for the idea of the university. The second of those genres is often now seen as imperiled, discredited, or at least in its liberal forms, entirely defunct. The first is in rather better shape, but its concern is obviously with only one aspect of the broad range of practices that have come to be grouped since the 1940s under the term humanities. The value of the humanities certainly includes qualities associated with poetry and with liberal education. But the dual comparison highlights a problem of scale. Any claims you might want to make for the humanities have to be rather less specific than in the case for poetry and rather more specific than in the case for the university. Given the difficulties, there is a serious temptation to insist that ongoing practical commitment's enough. And yet there are situations, most obviously the one to respond to demands from government and university administrators who answer to government, that those who study and teach the humanities should be able to articulate the public value of their work. Situations which make it impossible for us really to decline. And I think it's no bad thing. There is, I suppose, a personal context for this series of lectures as well, that I find myself presented with the question, what is the public value of what you do? Not able to articulate, at least when I started, not able to articulate a series of reasons that satisfied me. So what you'll be hearing here is in part just someone trying to get her head in order. Now, the hardest of those situations of justification to government involves justifying the humanities' claim to a share of the public budget for research. So writing this book was done against a background of an intense, as you'll be well aware, an intense public debate about successive British governments' incremental retreat from the idea that the state should bear the cost, or most of the cost, of higher education. But the state still pays for research in the humanities, as it pays also for research in the social sciences and sciences. It underwrites the cost of every undergraduate's education, and it subsidises graduate education for many. It may not seem to you many enough, but, you know, a considerable number. The most politically pressing question at the point of writing is what the state thinks it's paying for in the case of the humanities, and whether the people who make decisions about public spending can be helped to recognise the distinctive nature of humanities scholarship. That's a much more accurate word than research, and distinctive contributions to the public good. So the primary aim of these lectures is going to be to examine the most commonly proffered reasons why the study of the humanities has distinctive purpose and value for us as individuals and as a society. My approach is going to be taxonomic, and my hope is partly an ambitious one, that it may help people who are tasked with accounting to the public exchequer for what we do to have a taxonomic, a kind of clarity about the arguments that we use, where they come from. In practical decision-making circumstances, it seems desirable for the sake of accuracy and clarity to understand that there are multiple distinct ways in which the humanities can be said to have public value, to be cognizant of the different senses of the term value involved, the different contexts in which they hold good, and the quite different kinds of contribution made to the public good. The dual aim of what I'm doing here is then to borrow a phrase from the American critic Amanda Anderson, who is in turn, of course, reworking a title of Trollope. that we may improve the way we argue now as academics debating among ourselves and as representatives of our universities and our disciplines facing outwards to the general public. Also, that it may improve the way we as a society debate the public good of the humanities. That's, of course, a much looser and more ambitious we, and the status of that we in debate about value of the humanities will be taken up especially in the lecture on democracy, our contribution to democracy. However public the external prompts and hoped for effects, as I said, I wouldn't have tackled the subject if it didn't seem to me attractively difficult. And the fact that the subject is the direction towards of our arguments towards the public good doesn't make them for me any the less personally involving. Right, the lectures in these series then we're going to identify five arguments for the value of the humanities that have been influential historically and that still have persuasive power. Each of those can yield more specific arguments, which I'll treat here as logically subordinate or attendant, but other people might want to treat them as distinctive and deserving of more notice in their own right. Together, they offer a pluralistic account of value. One of my assumptions is that any persuasive account of the humanities' contribution to the public good has to be so plural, and that pluralism doesn't entail incoherence. It's an understandable consequence of the political pressure to produce compelling justifications that many advocates for the public value of the humanities have sought to locate a single claim that will overpower all imagined resistance. That seems to me the most obvious reason, or one of the obvious reasons, for the popularity in recent years of the democracy needs us defence. I don't think there is any all-silencing justification to be had, rather a number of distinct defences, each arising out of particular ways of thinking about value, purpose, and the nature of the implied opposition. A defence is, after all, a defence against a perceived threat, which may be a defined set of alternative needs and values, economic instrumentalism, for example, or an exclusive empiricism, or a narrowly quantitative estimation of human happiness. Or it may be the more impersonal threat posed by an inhospitable economic climate in which all public goods are subject to much tougher demands for justification. In all these contexts, not just the last, the threat to the humanities will be one facet of a threat to the good working of the university as a whole. Let me say a word about tone. A defence that pits one area of intellectual activity against the others risks becoming what the historian John Burrow once animatedly observed and would be a raft of Medusa, a boatload of castaways cannibalising each other to survive. Ironic high comedy, he suggested, may be preferable under really unfavourable conditions to the default temptation towards lament or the tragic dignity of defending a last bastion. The prospect of death by starvation, he added with comic exaggeration, and more optimistically than not, concentrates the mind. I thought a lot about tone in the writing of this book, and I think partly as in the course of my own reaction against or desire to do something different from the polemical and the manifesto approach, I thought very hard about which kinds of tone might work for this, but of course tone develops out of what you are and what you tend to do anyway. It's in part an outcrop of one's developed style. I'm told my own is acerbic, and I think I'm fairly happy with that description, oddly enough. If what it brings to it is a kind of toughness, I hope it's toughness towards the way we argue, the degree to which we focus our own criteria for good debate upon our own debates, then okay, I'm happy to stand up for that. The main claims for the value of the humanities that I'm going to look at are, number one, that they study the meaning-making practices of the culture, focusing on interpretation and evaluation with an indispensable element of subjectivity. Strictly speaking, that's not a claim for value. It's a justification for the humanities based on perceptions of their distinctive disciplinary character and their distinctive understanding of what constitutes knowledge. It differentiates them implicitly or explicitly from the social sciences and the sciences, where the emphasis on subjectivity is less strong, though it's not nil. Any assertions of value attached will be secondary to that description of purpose. I'm placing it first because it has a kind of logical priority, also because it commands, I think, widespread conviction, and it is, I think, right. But it's a crude supporting, often incorrect assumptions about the disciplinary differences between the humanities, the sciences, and the social sciences. The traditional point of comparison, sometimes opposition, for the humanities has been the sciences. More recently, there's been a shift to casting the social sciences in that role, given the influence they're seen as exerting on government through schools of economics and business and management. I'm going to be arguing that it's vital to preserve a core description of the distinctiveness of humanistic interpretation. There are clear and definitive differences between the kinds of work pursued in the different faculties of the university. But there are very good reasons, I think, to be wary of reinventing the two cultures debate with the social sciences now misdescribed as the antagonist. Secondly, the claim that the humanities are useful to society in ways that put pressure on how governments commonly understand use. especially their prioritization of economic usefulness and the means of measuring it. There's a very old line of argument that the humanities are necessary, some will say laudably useless, or at a remove from accounts of practical ends and economic utility. This has been a common line of resistance to political economists from Adam Smith onwards, who've stressed usefulness as a desirable aim of publicly funded education. More recent advocates for the humanities have worked hard to invert the long-standing defence, arguing with pretty good evidence that they make a significant contribution to the knowledge economy and to the economy proper. Cut the pretty, it is good evidence. It's measurable in terms of the benefits to GDP, footfalls in bookshops, museums, theatres, heritage sites and so forth. Though some people who hang on to the old claim defend it absolutely, so they deem the value of the humanities to be deformed or betrayed as soon as questions of utility or application are brought into consideration, a more plausible interpretation, I think, treats usefulness as a legitimate but only minor or secondary and often accidental aspect of humanities scholarship's public value. I'm particularly interested in the version of this moderate claim that sees the use value of the humanities as pertinent to the evaluation of a basic or primary education, but diminishing in importance as one goes up the scale into higher education, where one is almost by definition dealing with forms of inquiry whose value is more intangible or not yet known. This tapering away of use value, I'll come back to what I mean by that term, will be less true for some other disciplines, notably medicine and the applied sciences and social sciences. But there will be a strong measure of truth in the description wherever new and unfettered intellectual inquiry is involved. Right, the third claim is that the humanities have a contribution to make to our individual and collective happiness. This may be the least trusted line of defence now, I think, within the humanities themselves, but it has a distinguished history and renewed topicality within government at the time of writing, and I suspect that the resistance to it is fading fast. Efforts to understand gains to the public good in ways that go deeper than economic benefits have received serious attention in recent years, and there have been some warm encouragements to think of the emotions and passions as themselves goods. So the fourth lecture, Socrates Dissatisfied, explores the grounds for a qualitative hedonistic argument for the humanities. I'm going to be testing it, the weight of that argument as a means of rebalancing those arguments that stress too exclusively the humanities' critical function. The core assertion here is going to be not the obviously overpitched one that the humanities will make you happy, rather that the humanities can help us to understand better what happiness is, how we may better put ourselves in the way of it, and how education may improve the kind and quality of some of our pleasures. For Mill, the impediment in the way of securing the larger claim that they can improve the quality of the society's happiness was the difficulty of persuading individuals interested in their own happiness and presumed to be egoistically motivated why they should care also for the collective or general well-being. That problem can still detain politicians. I think it does detain politicians. It's less likely to worry utilitarian philosophers for whom the goal just is individual psychological improvements. You aggregate them, that's what utilitarianism does, famously. Right, the fourth claim, democracy needs us. This is the most politically ambitious argument now regularly heard for the humanities in Britain. It's clearly a claim that one would want to have on one side if one can make it secure. It has a proximate source in the American liberal arts tradition and prominent recent exponents in Martha Nussbaum, Geoffrey Harpham, and in the UK, Frances Mulhern. Its longer roots lie in Socrates' claim to be a sort of gadfly given to the polis. In the fifth lecture, I'm going to be examining the strengths and potential weaknesses of the classical model and making a case for adapting and modernizing what was in its origins a description of the philosopher as isolated adjutant, not as it now needs to be a description befitting institutionally based professionals. I'm going to suggest that we should treat with caution any version that lends unduly narrowed and exclusive importance to the humanities on the basis of their serious but not definitive role in assisting informed and properly critical judgments on social and political life. There is, I think, a very frequent slippage from giving an account of what's effectively the university to an account that prioritises the claim of the humanities here. Proponents of the democracy needs us argument also need to work harder if they're going to explain satisfactorily how and why, when adopted by higher education professors and students, this argument doesn't commit us to a guardianship model of the democracy that many of us would instinctively resist. Shouldn't we rather trust the intelligence of the majority of sufficiently but not highly educated people? But with those caveats in place, the claim stands that the humanities, centrally concerned as they are with the cultural practices of reflection, argument, criticism, and speculative testing of ideas, have a substantial contribution to make to the good working of democracy. The final claim I'm going to explore is that the humanities matter for their own sake. A common feature of all the other justifications treated is that they are consequentialist, resting on a conviction that the humanities have good effects in the world by their impact on our cultural life, our happiness, our politics. I should say that isn't strongly the case for the first one, the argument by distinction against other disciplines, but it's true of the argument with instrumentalism, the argument about happiness, the democracy argument. That consequentialism is going to be attractive to anyone who's tasked with demonstrating the humanities' public benefit, but it neglects what's often been thought of as the intrinsic value of the subject studied, with good reason. Intrinsic value has been something of an embarrassment as a criterion for aesthetic and other modes of judgment. It runs counter to many modern critics' understanding of how pervasively valuations are coloured by the perceiver's interests. It's also frequently hampered by being drawn into a mistaken opposition with instrumental value. So I'll be considering the most influential efforts to secure the claim to intrinsic value, but I conclude that this isn't finally the ground humanities scholars want to be on. We'll do better to argue for the value of the objects and practices that matter to us by calling on long-standing intuitions of value, often taken as self-evident by the wider public, and relatedly on the ground of long-standing cultural settlements and evolving agreements about how and why the humanities have value for their own sake, a value that's neither purely intrinsic nor merely subjective. Okay, it'll be apparent from this outline, this initial outline of the terrain, that my approach to the subject's political, and it's been driven in part by topical concerns. It's also, however, more fundamentally, or for want of a better word, abstractly philosophical. My aim's been to avoid as far as possible immersion only in the current state of institutional debate, which dates remarkably quickly, and to try to ascertain instead what the grounds of argument are in each of the conventional claims, where they work, what they imply, under what conditions they will cease to have credibility or have to acknowledge limits on their credibility. To an extent, I'm also interested in genealogies of argument, though clearly I'm not attempting here a proper history of arguments for the humanities. Nobody trained in the study of the 19th century can fail to perceive that the arguments going on today about the value of the humanities have deep roots in the efforts of many of the best remembered Victorian writers to articulate for their period the value of a liberal education and culture, including extensive attention to humane letters. The grounds of argument are in many cases much older than that, but the Victorian period retains explanatory importance because it's then that one sees emerging the now familiar pressure to justify expenditure on educating students in the humanities in the face of resistance from many political economists. It's also then that one starts to see the critical distinction within the remit of a liberal education between the work of the humanities and the work of the sciences and social sciences. And it's then that there emerges a conscious division of approach between those thinkers, often identified in the period as utilitarian, who approach questions of public value by prioritising the desired end for society, an increase in prosperity and or general well-being, and those who understand the proper focus of attention to be the cultivation of the individual mind. Finally, it's in that period that there takes hold the idea that the extension of education is a democratic good, that it is indeed a prerequisite for a properly functioning democracy. The understanding that this extension should include higher education is not obviously implied, but it's put down gradually strengthening roots over recent decades in America and relatively recently in Britain. I am not the first to argue that many of today's debates about the value of the university, of education, of the arts and humanities specifically, bear the traces of these earlier imprints. Many of the best contributions to debate, I've given you these on your reading list, many of the best contributions have made the same observation. All of Sheldon Rothblatt's writing, I've given you a selection there, about the history of the university, stresses the critical importance of the 19th century in shaping subsequent developments. Bill Redding structures his painfully disenchanted and still compelling analysis of the state of today's universities, in the book called The University in Ruins, around the contrast between the Humboldtian University of Culture and today's internationally marketized University of Excellence. Stefan Collini's What Are Universities For?, which came out last year, constructs its opening arguments against ongoing marketization in the form of a critical dialogue with Victorian idealism. By way of justification for this historical emphasis, it would, I think, be hard to improve on Dinah Birch's Our Victorian Education, 2008. As she observes, our societies inherited from the Victorians a driving belief in the value of education that shaped and continues to shape our society for the better. But we also owe to them patterns of joint debate and often bitter disputation about what university should be about, what it should be for, who should pay for it, and how we can best be sure of its worth. She rightly concludes that we haven't resolved these disputes, and simply recalling earlier thinking won't get us far. But a sound understanding of the origins of our present problems may show us ways in which we can begin to extricate ourselves. This is definitely going to be more the case with some arguments than others. In two of the lectures that you'll be hearing, the Victorian imprint on debate, though it's palpable, is much less salient than later transformations of the grounds of defence. So the second lecture's examination of two and three cultures' arguments, as they've helped and hindered definition of the distinctive work of the humanities, has to acknowledge the formative role played by T.H. Huxley's long-running public argument with Matthew Arnold about the relative priority of literature and science in a liberal educational curriculum. Their influence on contemporary ways of articulating the distinctive purpose of the humanities is, however, obviously less relevant and less remembered now than C.P. Snow and F.R. Leavis's antagonistic reworking of the same terrain in the late 1950s and early 1960s, or indeed Alan Sokal's contribution in the 1990s, his argument with Social Text, the editors of Social Text Journal. Changes in the political and institutional context within which the humanities function have substantially altered the framework for such claims. Although, as I'm going to be arguing, the dead hand of convention has been especially oppressive in this sphere of argument. Similarly, the democracy needs us claim has to be cognizant of marked differences between Victorian political contexts and those of today. This claim is, for obvious historical reasons, all but absent from English traditions of defence until pretty recently. It's missing even from the Victorian educational and political literature where you might expect to find it. For example, the writing of William Morris. Most of the leading Victorian defenders of humane letters, so Mill, Ruskin, Newman, Arnold, Patterson, would have agreed in seeing the Socratic model as the origin of modern forms of dialectical argument, and in its accent on the character and ethos of the teacher's influence on the pupil, the ideal educational model. Some, not all of them, held that the objectives of education should include the formation of good citizens. None of them thought that the arts and humanities had a privileged, let alone primary, role to play in training people for civic responsibility. Politically, most of us have long ago evolved past their reservations about democracy. Where there are reservations now, they tend to be about the functionality of democracy, not about whether it is itself a good and desirable thing. But the sense that the political good of higher education depended on its breadth, not on any narrow claims on behalf of the humanities, still requires a critical response, I think. We can also ask whether our circumstances now are so different as to legitimate the argument on different grounds from the ones available to Victorian thinkers. For example, do we now inhabit a public sphere so distortively geared to thinking in terms of economic profitability that we need a corrective input from the humanities to redirect our attention to human goods more variously described? I think we do, though it seems to me too narrowly territorial a claim that such corrective thinking is exclusively our task. One recent institutional development, which has run alongside the writing of this book, offers to significantly alter the weighting given to the democratic claim, and I need to say just a quick word about it here. The potential of higher education to encourage the evolution of democratic structures and assist democratic practices has been greatly enhanced, at least in theory, it's just starting to be tested now, by the arrival of massive open online courses, MOOCs. The economic model for those courses is still in the early stages of development in the UK, so you've probably seen newspaper reports just in the last month that the initial constellation of 12 universities trying them out is being supplemented by another 5. If their popularity continues, as current patterns suggest and as models taken from the state suggest, they will, I think, present a deep challenge to the Socratic model of teaching as the mode of assisting individual education. But they're also likely to boost the credibility of arguments that seek to harness the humanities training in language use, the evidences of history, varieties of culture, and philosophical inquiry to the good working of democracy. If nothing else, they'll be the first real opportunity we've had for serious sociological testing of those claims. For the distinctions argument, then, the import of historical comparisons monetary. If we follow the history of those arguments too closely, we'll be arguing badly. In the case of the democracy needs us argument, it's a reminder that our argumentative needs are, in the UK at least, relatively new. Our problems are not especially well defined by our past. But there are two conventional modes of arguing for the value of the humanities that warrant, I think, closer attention to earlier historical modes of defence. That's the argument with instrumentalism and the argument for a contribution to happiness. It seems to me that in both these instances, we are in danger of forgetting what earlier advocates for the humanities knew well, the power and limitations of these particular lines of reasoning, even granting major differences in the context and audiences of debate. So I'm going to ask you in those lectures to go fairly deeply into Mill on happiness and Arnold on graduated use value. As I said, what we mean by use value here is about to be defined more properly. At those points, you should expect a cranking up of the scholarly apparatus in keeping with the shift to historical reclamation as well as philosophical scrutiny. Okay, so the third lecture's exploration of use value is going to examine one route out of the familiar structural opposition between use and uselessness. That focus has been prompted by a comparative reading of Culture and Anarchy, 1869, with reports that Arnold was writing in the same period when he was working as an education department inspector of schools and universities. Now, I'm clearly not giving you here the Marxist definition of use value as pure non-economic consent to a lived need, as against economic exchange value. Use value for Arnold meant something much closer to the common currency of today's government policy directives to enhance practical use as an end of education. He wrote Culture and Its Enemies, the lecture that formed the kernel of Culture and Anarchy, in the immediate aftermath of 2 years' work reporting on schools and universities on the continent, in the course of which he had ample cause to reflect on the validity but also the limits of instrumentalism in education. To read Arnold on primary schools is to find someone absolutely prepared to talk in terms of practical use value, especially when standards of attainment are low for historically or politically contingent reasons. But even in those circumstances, he hardly ever allows himself to talk just in those terms. Use value is important for him at the beginning of any individual's schooling, but higher and longer term ways of thinking about the good of education quickly come into play. They include the power to use your intelligence freely or non-mechanically, not least in maintaining skepticism towards any self-serving claims about the greater importance of one area of study over another. For Arnold, this controlled appeal to use makes a point about public values, but also a point about the language in which we debate and uphold them. One of the reasons why Culture and Anarchy continue to hold such a prominent place in the critical literature on the meaning and value of culture, heavily contested, but no less strong for that, is that though it was written by a man that you could, without stretching the term too far, call a bureaucrat, it concedes almost nothing to the formulaic language of bureaucracy that standardly places a high value on practical usefulness and economic utility. His alternative terms of validation didn't last very long, and I want to talk about that. He knew that sweetness and light wasn't going to last long in the language, or didn't want it to. But he knew that this fate is going to befall any language that attempts to fix the value of culture. I'm interested in the reverberations of that strategy for today's defences of culture and education. And I'll be arguing, of course, that Arnold's conclusion retains validity, and it doesn't need to bring in its train his high cultural assumptions. The most famous formulation of the improvement in happiness argument for the humanities even now is John Stuart Mill's description of how reading Wordsworth rescued him from the mental aridity of an unsentimental education. His claims for poetry have clear continuities with the romantic valuation of feeling over reason, but they also show him going back to the roots of utilitarianism and Epicurean hedonism. So lecture four is going to be looking at Mill in order to test the weight of qualitative hedonistic arguments as a means of rebalancing claims that place all the emphasis on the humanities' critical function. Mill gave us some widely respected reasons for saying that poetry specifically, but by implication all writing that assists the cultivation of feeling, can help us to understand better what happiness is and how we can better put ourselves in the way of it, though doing so will never be entirely within our control. In Utilitarianism and Other Writings on Politics and Education, he also gave us some good reasons to support a claim that a liberal higher education with literature, language, and history in its remit may, for that relatively small proportion of the population that pursues it, increase the kind and quality of their individual intellectual pleasures. In that vein, he has been an acknowledged influence on some recent writing in behavioral economics, though you'll hear me being stroppy about this in that lecture. The majority of writers in that field seem to me astonishingly unaware that their subject has a philosophical history. In his role as rector of St. Andrews University in the 1870s, Mill argued more directly for the importance of the humanities as one element in a liberal education, on the grounds that they help to preserve the cultural inheritance for following generations in ways that aren't merely custodial but assist ongoing human intellectual and cultural achievements. All these things said, he put a check on any too ambitious claim for the humanities' role in promoting the happiness of society, and he identified some pretty serious problems in the way of connecting gains in individual happiness to that great utilitarian goal, quantifiable improvements in the general happiness. The last lecture in the series, for its own sake, is going to take us into some pretty close attention to philosophy of value, but its conclusions will encourage greater movement away from any historical precedent than we've yet seen. The idea that the humanities have value in their own right in ways that aren't primarily consequentialist or to be accounted for by evidence of their instrumental effects in the world has had very strong advocates in the last 2.5 centuries, among them Ruskin in the Victorian period and Geoffrey Hill rereading Ruskin and others at the end of the 20th century. Both those men attempted to secure the ground for valuation by reference to intrinsic value. readers of Hill in recent years have often detected a declining level of conviction in his writings on this subject over recent years. Awareness that such an argument now has to be knowingly failed, though it's not to be absolutely abandoned. So that last lecture is going to explore these efforts to redeem intrinsic value, briefly contrasting Hill's astringency with the more optimistic defense of intrinsic value offered by John Dewey. I'm then going to develop, in the place of the intrinsic value, attempts at the intrinsic value claim, what I think is the more readily defensible claim that the areas of study we now call the humanities have value for their own sake. Though the for its own sake claim isn't without its own difficulties, it's relatively free of the fetishistic quality often attached to belief in intrinsic value. And it doesn't, I think, require the value isolationism that has derailed many attempts to defend and define intrinsic value over the years. We look to past educational debates not for the sake of analogy, Sheldon Rothblatt warns, for analogy is limiting, rather for the sake of recognition. That's right, but there are evident points at which continuities are imperfect and where recognition, in some cases, is going to be quite baffled. Most obviously, the term humanities has no close equivalent in earlier periods beyond the relatively vague language and letters. It arose out of American efforts to define the special qualities of the study of literature, language, history, and the arts in response to an aggressive form of positivism, I'm quoting Stefan Collini here, that in the 1940s and 50s promoted the supposed methods of the natural sciences as the basis for all true knowledge. Even now, the humanities remains arguably a more American than English term, though it's certainly entering our institutional arrangements fast. And that the reason for that is pretty obviously the extent to which the single honours system still dominates in England. For well over a century, the predominant model of university education here has been deep study of one discipline during your undergraduate years, with still more specialised study following at graduate level. Very few English universities offer the liberal, in the sense of broad, educational base favoured in America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and many other national systems that I'm less familiar with. And given a university system where most students specialise from the start, the term humanities is going to, I think, tend to operate mainly as an administrative grouping of departments on the basis of fairly loosely observed similarities in subject matter or approach. Now, having said that, there are, I think, quite interesting moves to broaden the reach of liberal arts-like programs in British universities. And so the main models I can think of are England, including Exeter. I think Edinburgh is trialing them, has been trialing them for a while in Scotland. So I think that where the pressures from that are coming from will be differently described depending who you talk to. You know, a desire to meet more international students is sometimes given as the reason. But more often, I think, a sense that something ought to be done to counter the narrowing of specialisation and allow people, you know, a breadth of choice at the point of entry to university and developing sense of where their interests lie through the course of their time there. I think all the models that are currently being played with do limit themselves to that first year as well, but you can find out more talking to your friends. The kinds of subject matter studied within the humanities have evolved a very long way as well from the Victorian philological, historical, and critical practices that were scooped up in that term, humane letters. So the field most of you come from, English literature, wasn't widely studied at university level, as you'll know, until the start of the 20th century. And it's since been completely reshaped in its content, well, almost completely reshaped in its content and its methods of inquiry many times over. There have been really fundamental changes in what we comprehend by the term culture, of course. There are continuing disagreements about the relative claims of aesthetics, politics, and sociological considerations in defining the terrain and the purpose of literary study. And you don't even have to call them disagreements, I think, just a right recognition of the mixed nature of the subject. And that's taken us a long way from Arnold's The Best That Has Been Thought and Said. Faced with the very diverse kinds of study grouped under the humanities, you could easily despair of generalizing. I'm put in mind of Derek Parfit's observation with respect to that similarly vague designation, the arts, that music is the lost battlefield and graveyard of most aesthetic theories. It's not easy, in other words, to come up with a definition of the humanities that can easily comprehend the study of Sufi mysticism, English literary criticism, Middle and High German, analytic philosophy. You know, you add your own components to the description. But as an administrative term, it does seem to be here to stay for the foreseeable future. The continuing contribution of ideas about liberalism to debates about the content and value of higher education in the humanities presents another kind of difficulty. It's conventional to identify most, though not all, of the Victorian writers I've invoked thus far with liberal thought, but that's a term that famously sets a whole stream of semantic confusions running. Rothblatt summarizes it well. The history of liberal education, he writes, does not evolve or descend. It dissolves. It is the narrative of a series of departures from a classical conception of wholeness or integration, which appears to be a natural way of viewing the human condition, beginning with the balance presumed essential to the mental and bodily health and extending to the necessary and palpable interdependence of people. This irregular historical descent he's talking about continues even now to put serious difficulties in the way of thinking about what the aims of education should be. So this is him again. Appeals to an idea of roundedness really fall on deaf ears, but the deeper assumptions upon which ancient ideas of liberal education rest are actually incomprehensible from the standpoint of present-day conceptions of personality. They're not compatible with that other meaning of the term liberal, the idea of an autonomous self in competition with other selves for status, income, position, influence, or with our belief in the importance of skills, proficiencies, and specialities. So given the splintering of that term liberal, its ability to stand for quite disconnected and even contradictory ideals, wholeness and specialism, interdependence and freedom, it might well be preferable to avoid it altogether. And in addition, it's a word that now carries in many quarters strongly pejorative connotations of nostalgia and, worse than that, denial of the actual economic circumstances of modern education. For those who hold that we're now in the midst of a thoroughgoing economic neoliberalism, liberalism's often little more than a cover for conservatism. I've restricted the way I'm going to be using the word in these lectures to occasions when the contextualization of a particular mode of defense in a particular history of thinking warrants it. I've tried also to indicate when the designation of a liberal broad basis for curricula ought to be clearly detached from any assumption that political liberalism is implied or entailed. The increasing number of university courses requiring a liberal arts component at the introductory level is some evidence of a growing conviction in recent years that UK education would benefit from some liberalisation in that sense of content. That conviction is also evidenced in the wide popularity of interdisciplinary work and ever-growing government incentives to pursue it. Nevertheless, as I'm going to point out in the second lecture, interdisciplinary work remains, with rare exceptions, work pursued from one primary disciplinary base. So examples you'll be familiar with: the literary thesis pursued with a substantial component of history of ideas or history of science, the musicology thesis that draws closely on the methods and findings of anthropology. Just, I'm not sure whether it's an aside or a kind of, you know, entirely logically required rant at this point. I want to say that I'm becoming increasingly skeptical of the value of that word, interdisciplinarity, and indeed it's just its usefulness as it's being employed by research funding bodies. The primary function of the term interdisciplinarity in UK higher education policy making at the moment is pretty obviously to assist funding bodies in meeting the government imposed requirement that public money should promote knowledge transfer, economic relevance, and impact or social benefit. That's not in itself a bad thing, but the word interdisciplinarity has been effectively harnessed so as to encourage applications that will be self-evidently collaborative because they involve skills and often personnel from more than one department, self-evidently innovative because they're not confined by the intellectual and methodological parameters of existing disciplines, and will self-evidently involve the transfer of knowledge beyond old disciplinary boundaries. So interdisciplinarity in those contexts is always deemed to be a good, but it's very problematically underdefined. It doesn't designate a subject or a method. At most, it's a framework, and I'm especially suspicious of its value when it's invoked as an answer to the question of what the future of our separate fields of inquiry should be. In other words, absolutely fine if you can identify a purposive reason for putting two particular disciplines together to extend or correct or, you know, be in dialogue with each other, but when it just stands there as if it provides its own answers to the demand that you be reaching outside your own narrowness of definition, it seems to me increasingly a bit of a cheat. One of the ways in which my thinking's changed significantly in the course of researching and writing about this topic has been with the growing realization that American and English traditions of defense for the humanities are rather less compatible than I expected to find them. I mean, that may have been my own ignorance, but it is striking that in conversation on these topics within Britain, we very readily reach for the American examples in the debate. Indeed, I think they're often the prominent models we reach for. Many of the most high-profile recent defenses have come out of the assaults on, or perceived assaults on, the real assaults on the American liberal arts system, including Martha Nussbaum's not-for-profit, Luc Menand's The Marketplace of Ideas, and Jeffrey Harpham's The Humanities and the Dream of America. They've all come out within the last 3 years. They've found a ready and, in the main, sympathetic audience in the UK, and certainly much of the critical literature that I found most helpful, so for example the work of John Guillory and Amanda Anderson, has come from that section of the American literary profession, principally in English and theory, which has concerned itself with the political responsibilities of the academy and the profession. These are very thought-provoking writers, but they are often distinctively American in their concerns. They're responding to greater pressures to redirect funding from the humanities towards vocational and business studies than have yet operated in Britain, and more worrying drops in the overall numbers and relative proportion of students studying the humanities at undergraduate level. The core concern is often with faltering commitments on the part of state governments and individual institutions to liberal arts education from primary school upwards. Their responses can seem, to an external eye, sometimes excessively preoccupied with the question of whether and how to reduce numbers of doctoral students, given the reduced opportunities for entry into the academic profession, and how to reverse a process which isn't yet true, though it may be becoming true in the UK, by which graduate teaching has come to be valued at the expense of undergraduate teaching. You may not feel that's your experience to date, but it may be on the horizon. They have also been more preoccupied, these writers, with threats to academic freedom, necessarily so, I think, given the extent of budget control by US state legislators and the degree of interference in the content of education in some universities. The case in England and Britain isn't the same. It would be difficult to say whether it's better or worse, other than on a case-by-case basis, the major difference being the greater centralisation of the economic framework for higher education and of research funding and assessment policy. The relative rarity of elective courses here removes the major source of demand for the humanities found in the US liberal arts system, but it also removes their most immediate vulnerability to changes in any given institution's commitment to that system. Now, in part because the liberal arts model has been so important historically and ideologically in the States, in part also because of the much greater number of privately funded institutions of education in the higher education system, and the more entrenched resistance to the idea that the state, in the British sense of that word state, should provide. Public good doesn't automatically register a government-funded good in the US as it does in the UK. So I think the kinds of claim investigated here are going to look different to transatlantic eyes. To take just the most obvious example, I suspect, do I fear, I'm not sure, that my reservations about the extent to which one can push the democracy needs this argument are going to be weighed differently by readers within a liberal arts system. I suspect they're going to look excessively or unhelpfully sceptical. But even if you're in that system, there seems to me a need to ensure that the corrective function that's often ascribed to a broadly informed liberal intelligence doesn't become a claim for a specific humanities advantage without explaining how and why the humanities should be thought to have a special purchase on critical intelligence, or even historical critique or rhetorical analysis. A large question for anyone trying to assess the force of historic justifications now, in almost any national context, is whether talk of non-market values of whatever political cast, where the goals of higher education are concerned, still has any purchase in an economic context that many people will describe after the American example as neoliberal, in other words, thoroughly under the sway of market forces. A more strenuous description, neoliberalism is the name given to a mode of government understood to be globally in the ascendant, in which all dimensions of human life are cast in terms of a market rationality, and under which in England the role of the state is to deploy a variety of strategies, including privatisation, deregulation, re-regulation, commercialisation and marketisation, to quell resistance to that market rationality, preferably to make us enthusiastic adherents to it. I'm taking that definition from Sarah Amsler, an essay called Beyond All Reason in the fall 2011 issue of Representations. There's a variety of hard-headed realism as it presents itself that would have us believe in such a context that non-market-directed arguments have all been made well enough before and that the time for making them has passed. The best we can hope for now is that we can persuade governments that the humanities are important to the marketplace, and more ambitiously that university administrations might be able to exploit the logic of commerce on our own behalf. They might, for example, seek to abduct rhetorically, perhaps more than rhetorically, the figure of the financial derivative and apply it to the ways in which research grants, league tables, university strategic plans can leverage the value of higher education before it's realised. Now, that seems to me a mistake on several levels. First, I just don't think that our students or the parents or benefactors who increasingly fund their higher education have ceased to possess higher ideas about what an education in the humanities should be for. Nor do most of them, I think, set much store by inflated promissory notes as against the visible content of curricula, the scholarly achievement of the teachers in those institutions, the reported experience of current or recent students. That's probably the most important of all. Nor have most academics, I think, entirely parted company with their idealism. Even when they sound most stroppy or most cynical, I think that's because there is a kind of embattled or bereaved idealism at work. Not least, I think that's because most of us have been greatly the beneficiaries of early generations' idealism.
Secondly, though the arguments for considering higher education in the humanities a public good have been well made and many times over, they haven't, I think, been made in ways that clearly enough distinguish different kinds of justification from one another. So clearly that's the task I'm taking on. In particular, there seems to me some virtue and some usefulness in a taxonomic defence of the humanities based on the value, on the assumption of value pluralism. There's one further error, I think, in the hard-headed view that the time for non-market-led value claims is over, and that's an error in the description of neoliberalism. Public culture and higher education certainly inhabit a market, but the market isn't free in the UK. It remains in important ways constrained politically, legally, ethically. And not the least of the constraints upon it is what the informed public will bear in the way of marketisation. Regulations often cynically perceived as a means by which neoliberal governmentality produces a distorted market in which thinly described standards of performance mask the loss or the active dismantling of humanistic aspirations for education. You can apply this same critique to broadcasting or healthcare, other kinds of public good. The cynicism's partly, but only partly, justified. As long ago as 1996, in what remains one of the best modern books on the idea of the university, Bill Redding's diagnosed a major threat to the humanities and to the university as a whole, understood as a place of serious, rational, and imaginative intellectual culture. He saw the threat as arising from the imposition by administrations and government agencies of a distorted simulacrum of the marketplace, according to which what matters is the ostensibly quantifiable but increasingly contentless excellence of its teaching and research outputs. Turning back the tide of ill thought through grossly expensive and time-wasting systems of accounting for the receipt of public money, you can hear the person who's running the Ref and Impact exercises at the moment, is, I think, indeed one of the major problems facing universities and other public institutions today. So I think Redding's was right. But there's reason to resist taking his argument, as some have been tempted to do, all the way towards cynicism. Cynicism can be really alluring. It speaks historically and stylistically of critical independence, skepticism of the default moral currency, a willingness to debase the ideal stamp and thereby renew the possibility of a credible idealism that's sometimes going to be a better representation of the values we attach to intellectual life than a more measured argument can be. But the cynic position in this context tends to ignore the extent to which the value of a higher education, not only in the humanities, continues to be understood by students, teachers, parents, alumni, but also, in my experience, by some politicians and civil servants in ways that resist market valuation and economic quantification. So one of the things I'm most conscious of hearing from the few politicians and civil servants I've had a chance to talk to, but you know, not so few, is that what they need from us is better arguments. It's not that they're sitting with blocked ears pursuing marketization at no end. They want us to come up with the better reasons for them to hold on to what so many continue to value. I don't underestimate the extent of the damage that's been done to university education in Britain by saying that our institutional deformation isn't complete, and that protesting it, as Redding's did in writing The University in Ruins, has produced demonstrable victories. But the fact that the humanities continue to receive substantial sums of public investment, that our students are still publicly and in some privileged instances institutionally subsidised, that regulation in the form of assessment or scholarships is a matter of peer review and it's conducted by respected members of the profession, and most saliently that students, parents, teachers, and many politicians perceive the marketisation of higher education to be distorting its true value. These are all signs that we're operating under something other than full-blown neoliberalism, and reasons to keep cynicism in check, or optimism alive, if you like. One of the most damaging effects of a sense of embattlement, periodically evident in our cultures of debate, is that it can prevent advocates from the humanities, for the humanities, from doing one of the things that they can legitimately claim to do best: submitting claims of value to proper scrutiny, rhetorical, historical, philosophical. If the effect of the requirement for the humanities to justify their public value or the terms in which they're permitted to do so is to stifle their ability to ask the hard questions of their own intuitions of purpose and value, that's when they'll be in real trouble.